The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to this February 26, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Every single week, Barbara, Nicole, or I am here talking to authors about craft, content, writing, all things writing related, business writing related. I'm joined this morning by Erica Hayasaki, and coming up in the second half hour, James Scott will be here to discuss his debut novel, The Kept. Erica spent 9 years as a reporter for the LA Times, becoming an assistant professor in the literary journalism program right here at UCI. She is the recipient of the LA Times Best Writing Award, the Association of the Sunday Features Editors Award, and the American Society of Newspaper Editors Breaking News Award. Her book is The Death Class, A True Story About Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Erica, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm well. Are you, you must be close by. Are you here at UCI? Close by?
No, not at the moment. I live in Los Angeles, believe it or not, but I will be at UCI later today.
Poor you. So let's start off by talking about how you got interested in the class on death. I know you were doing a lot of grim reporting before this, but talk a little bit about on the death class, your relationship with the professor, Norma Bao, and a little bit of how you came to write the book.
Sure. So I was stationed in New York City as a national correspondent for the LA Times in 2007 and 2008. And I had just come out of covering some pretty tragic events. The Virginia Tech shootings was one story that I spent several weeks reporting in the aftermath. And, you know, I had gone into interview families who lost their loved ones on September 11th, and, you know, shootings and bridge collapses and lots of tragic, sad stuff. And so one day I came across a news article. Actually, it was a student newspaper who had written, a student had written a piece about a professor at King University in New Jersey who had this really wonderful class on death. And I was curious about that, and I thought, how, you know, what is a class on death, first of all, and who is this professor? And so I initially set out to write an article about the class, and I visited Professor Norma Bao and her students, and I spent some time with them. I did write an article. It ended up running on the front page of the LA Times. But then I stayed. I stayed for the next several years. For the first year, pretty intensely, almost visiting almost every day, and then continuing to visit and go on trips with the students and things like that for the next couple of years to write about her class and her and the professor. And I also took the class. I became a student as well. So I was a journalist, kind of as a fly on the wall in some parts, and then in other parts I was a student taking the class and doing the lessons and revisiting some of my own encounters with death.
So you think the death class was sort of an anecdote to your journalism covering death? So in other words, like, did the reporting on Virginia Tech and 9/11 increase your death anxiety while the death class reduced it?
I do think that my death anxiety was heightened because I had been covering such, you know, these events. My first part of the book, the beginning of the book talks about the first death that I ever covered, which was when I was 16, and it was the death of my friend who was murdered at the hands of her ex-boyfriend. And I covered that death as a journalist for my high school paper, and it happened to be on the same day of the Oklahoma City bombing. And so that was a day that really changed my life. And, you know, I went on to write for major newspapers and do this for a living, and you know, but you never really get a chance to kind of stop and process what this all means and why. As a reporter, you're going from story to story. So by getting into the deaf class and following the students, but also being there as a student myself, you know, I was able to look at this for a long period of time, to look at deaf, to talk to people, to process it, to look at it from a psychological perspective, you know, historical, to go into the field. By the way, the professor takes her students into, you know, morgues and cemeteries and prisons and hospice care. So all of that is part of the class as well. And that really did change the way I viewed death, kind of looking at it as much as a part of life, a process of life.
Right.
And decrease my death anxiety. I do believe that. Although I don't want to die anytime soon, that's for sure.
Yeah, because you had said the more you make death something that's not this sort of distant, spooky, horrific thing, but instead make it a part of your life, it sort of changes your perspective about it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, I don't know, jumping from one horrific event to the next, you know, that all of these events that are sort of lying at the extreme of our culture, Virginia Tech or 9/11, all of it, you know, and not having that, you know, severely impact your perspective on how you live your life.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, it's, you know, you're there in the immediate aftermath. Sometimes you're knocking on the doors of families who've just lost loved ones or are still waiting for their loved ones to come home and they might never come home. And, you know, that's not necessarily a class you get in journalism school, how to deal with those kind of intense events and moments and in your reporting and writing. And so, although I think I've incorporated some of that into my classes, my journalism classes at UCI, because I've had students who, you know, have been reporting on people. One student, actually, the person she was interviewing was ill and died, you know, over the course of the interview. So it is something that you have to deal with, but it's not something that you get classes on. And so this was a different kind of experience for me, for sure.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Erika Hayasaki. The book is The Deaf Class, A True Story About Life. I'm curious about how your perspective changed going into this, taking the death class and deciding to write about it versus maybe how you came out at the end of it. And if you came into it with sort of an agenda of how you were going to write about it and if that changed over the course of taking the class and writing it.
No, there was really no agenda. I just thought this would be a good idea. I didn't know exactly what I was getting myself into. With a story that you kind of immerse yourself into the world, it's called immersion journalism. You don't know where the end is going to be. It's different from when you reconstruct a story from beginning to end that's already happened and you kind of know your ending. But when you immerse, you know, you're following characters, you're following multiple people, you're getting into their lives, you don't know who's going to be a main character. You know, I must have been interviewed 50 different students and settled on a handful of them to be in the book. But you're following them over long periods of time. You don't know whose story is going to end up where. And so I didn't really know where it was going to go. I just kept with it because I was interested and I cared about the story and I cared about the topic and the people. And so, you know, so I eventually found my ending, but it's not like a novel where you have the perfect ending. You know, real life isn't perfect. And so, you know, it does have a nice ending, but, you know, all these things are not things that I could plan out, which is, you know, that's the challenge as a writer, because you're kind of getting all of this material and sifting through it and doing interviews and trying to figure out how you're going to structure when you don't have a natural structure kind of enforced in the book.
Right. Yeah, actually, that was going to be one of my questions, is writing literary nonfiction. I was wondering if there were any sort of inconvenient truths that you had to work around, you know, that the facts weren't fitting the story you were trying to tell, and how you kind of, you know, either reshape, I don't know if reshape is the right word, but how you deal with things that may not fit squarely in the book you're trying to write.
Right. Well, like I said, if you were to write a novel or a movie or something like that, everybody's moving together, perhaps through time at once, and their stories are unfolding, and they all come together in the climax at the right moment, you know, and realize it doesn't happen that way again, and you have multiple characters. So one challenge is people's stories are unraveling and unfolding at different times in you know, at different times. So
right.
You have people's backstories that have to be told as well. And those stories are not happening, you know, in the moment. You have to reconstruct those. So to tell a series of stories with a series of characters and make it run through the book in a way that, you know, you're not skipping around in time too much is a challenge. And I did that. I tried to keep everybody pretty much chronological for their in their particular stories,
mm-hmm.
And then kind of digressing into their backstories when need be. And then I also used the professor was a big, so she really admired this Erik Erikson psychologist who she studied in college, and he believed in these stages of life, and every stage you learn something, and the last stage, of course, is the stage before you die, and it was all kind of connected to, you know, every single stage before. So, and that was a big lecture that she did. So I actually studied Erikson further beyond her lectures and used that model because that was really who she admired as kind of a backbone for the book. You know, you had the different structures, the different stages of life, and within those stages I would bring in a character and show when they're going through the particular stages. So you end on, of course, the last stage of life too. So that was one technique. But, you know, it's tricky. You have to get creative and think of how you can make this book move in a way that's not necessarily the classic three-act structure with the, you know, exciting incident and the climax and the resolution.
Right. You know, the thing that I thought you handled so delicately and would be so difficult is all of these people came in, all of your characters, I'll call them characters, even though they're real people, came into a very guarded, you know, with incredibly visceral, you know, stories. And choosing them, first of all, I'd like to know about, and then getting them to open up. Norma herself is an incredibly inaccessible character initially, and then she opens up to you. And so I'm curious about your process in talking to these people and getting them to share their stories and kind of getting to their vulnerabilities so adeptly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because that's hard. That's probably one of the hardest parts. And for me, like I said, there were many different people that I interviewed. And I chose, for example, two characters, Jonathan and Caitlin, who were very involved with the professor, and also they were in love, so there was a love story there that I thought could be a kind of a side story that we could follow through. And one of the characters, Caitlin, she had OCD and death anxiety, and her mother was suicidal, and the other character, person, Jonathan, these are real people, real names, you know, he had watched his father murder his mother when he was very young. And but they had this very intense love story running through the book and running through their lives while they're dealing with all these very intense issues. And Norma Beau becomes this character who's stepping in and helping them in these moments of crisis. But you're right, all these people who are in the book are real, and they're protective of their stories. And for me to come in and put them in a book, you know, that's not something that necessarily comes easily, and, you know, to sit down and read your own story in a book also is very challenging. And so it took a lot of interviewing for Norma Beau in particular. She was excited about me writing about the class. When it came to writing about her, she was not excited. she in fact tried to avoid that at all costs, and didn't really reveal to me important things, like the fact that her father was in the mafia. Was involved in the mafia in New Jersey and New York. She didn't reveal that until about a year of interviewing, and then I got to meet him and interview him, of course. But that took a long time to get her to trust me, and then, you know, same with Caitlin, Jonathan, everybody else in the book. You know, I was very, very I was there a lot. I interviewed them multiple times. Sometimes the interviews turned into, you know, I mean, they were sobbing through interviews at times, and that's hard to do. And then the hardest part is when you write the entire book, and then you sit down because it's about, you know, it's going to be published, and and their lives are going to be out there. And I think that I, with every single character in the book, I sat down with them and prepared them for what was to come, and I let them know what I had included, because I didn't want them to be blindsided, you know, you know, or felt like they were taken advantage of in any way. Excuse me. And so I did that, and they weren't, you know, Norma wasn't happy with some parts of it, and, you know, same with other characters in the book. Not that it wasn't true, but more like, just very uncomfortable with having these personal things out there.
Right.
Or why do these have to, you know, and they would ask me, can we remove them? And so that's where you go through this. I mean, it's almost like giving a class on writing to the characters, because you have to explain to them, look, this tip for people to even to understand where you are and your how you became this person. They have to understand these various parts of your life, I feel. It makes you a more rounded character. And so once they understood that, they actually all kind of got behind it after it was published. We had a book event in New York, and all the characters, I keep calling them characters, which sounds
I
so
did
wrong,
that too.
But all the people in the book came and celebrated and got up and spoke, and Norma Beau has gotten behind her story, and 100%, you know, because it's all true. There's parts where, you know, she felt uncomfortable, and anybody reading their entire life in a book written by somebody else would feel uncomfortable and scared and vulnerable. But, you know, the most I can do is say that I'm going to write, you know, the truth as close as I could get to it. And then I also have that obligation to the reader that I'm trying to write around a, you know, story with characters and their complexities and all that. And so that was my goal, but it's not easy. I mean, I think that's one of the hardest parts, is because you're dealing with real people, real lives, and really, really sensitive topics. And so you have to handle those sensitively. It's different than being a journalist and writing a story, and it goes on the paper the next day, and then you move on. It's not that kind of story.
Right. It seems like this is one of the themes that she was teaching about was, you know, the more that you share your story and share your truths and share your anxieties, it takes the power out of the anxiety. It takes the fear out of you. And so perhaps by doing this, you know, she kind of was able to come to her own conclusions about, you know, kind of practice what you preach.
That. Yeah. She said that at the book events. You know, she for a very long time had been, you know, and that was part of the job. She had to be somebody who, she couldn't be a professor that goes in and starts airing all her problems to students. That's just not how it works. So she had this wall up and this kind of guard. But then she said, you know, for so many years I've asked all these students to share their stories and be part of the class. And so she really had to do her own work, do some of her own lessons for this whole project. And that was new to her. But she is comfortable now talking. I mean, I don't think she's completely comfortable talking about her story, but I mean, it's out there and people know, and that's a big step, I think, for her too. So, you know,
right.
It's an interesting process.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Erika Hayasaki. The book is The Death Class, The True Story About Life. One of the things that strikes me is the time of life that most of these students are coming to the class. And I've always had this philosophy about teenage suicide and the fact that a teenager or a young person has never really undergone a full cycle of pain. They haven't had some traumatic event that they've had to work through and come out the other side of. You know, the teenagers, I think, are kind of the first encounter with some sort of tragedy or some sort of pain that you can't see the other side of. And I was wondering, it seems like there's a certain type of person that was drawn to this class, and it felt like the exception that somebody came into the class just curious in general about death, that somebody had, you know, an association with this. And I was wondering if you were able to draw any conclusions over the kind of the class as a whole. You delved into individual people's stories, but looking at the class as a whole, the types of people that that are drawn to Norma.
Well, the class is waitlisted, so I don't know if I mentioned that, but there has been a 3-year waiting list for a long time, on and off, and so it fills up immediately. And there's usually at least 35 students in each class, and she teaches sometimes 2 a semester, and she teaches in the summer too. It's always full. The students are incredibly diverse. The campus is interesting. It's different than UC Irvine, but a lot of the same kind of students at the same time. I mean, very, very diverse, different socioeconomic backgrounds. A lot of people are working while going to school, have families maybe while going to school. So a lot of the students, they do come with their own issues. You know, you sit around on the first day of class and people talk about why they've come to the class. And not everybody reveals it in that moment, but some people, you know, there were plenty of students who would say, well, my brother committed suicide, you know, my boyfriend committed suicide, or somebody was killed in a car accident, my mother died of cancer. These things come out on the first day. And, you know, but then there are plenty of students who take it out of curiosity. I mean, you got to think about the field trips, too, is a big part of it. You know, everybody on campus is talking about you get to go see an autopsy, you get to go to prison. You know, what kind of class lets you do that? So you've got that bunch of students, too. So it's very, very diverse, the kind of students that come to the class, what they're looking for. I don't think they even know what they're getting themselves into a lot of times. It turns out to be a class where many, many things are revealed. Not everybody, you know, but you're sitting around every day, and the classes are 3 hours long, so it's a really long period to be together. And the assignments can be emotional. You know, I was able to do research into studies on death classes, and, you know, one study I included in the book talked about how a lot of students who come into death classes have been suicidal in the past. And that's something that any kind of person who's going to be a professor or teach a class like this, you know, they need to be aware that it's not necessarily the kind of class you can just teach out of a textbook. In fact, there have been also studies published. There's it was an academic journal called Death Studies, and they've done, you know, research on death classes as well. And their research showed that, you know, classes that are just textbook classes, where you kind of just go out of the textbook, it's very intellectual, and that's really where it ends, don't necessarily decrease death anxiety. In fact, they could increase death anxiety, whereas these classes that have these field trips where you're going into funeral homes and places like this and you're really experiencing and processing it on these different levels can decrease death anxiety. Mm. So I think that's interesting because I also think that it's important to note, because a lot of people are teaching death classes now. There's thousands. I mean, every single campus pretty much in the U.S. has some sort of death class on it usually now, and that's changed. There's an association for death education and counseling and death educators. You know, so there's a lot of people teaching death classes, and that's grown since the 1960s when there were a handful, and then there are a couple thousand, and now there's thousands and thousands. But how you teach it matters, and so Norma Bo is a different kind of teacher. She goes above and beyond, and I don't think that's every teacher's style, but she does have a mental health background. She was a nurse, and she's worked in psychiatric wards, and she's worked in these areas, so she's familiar with how to treat people who are, you know, coping and hurting and maybe dealing with things that are really serious. And also, she's very close to the counseling office on campus, so a lot of the students who need that get referred out of the class, really. Caitlin in the book was one of them. But it's something to keep in mind when thinking about a class like this.
it's almost hard to separate her from the class. I mean, she just seems so much a part of what the class is, aside from the subject matter. You know, she just sounds like this magnetic personality that, you know, people are camped out to be in her presence.
Right. Yeah, very much so. I mean, again, that's what made her an interesting character, too, for the book, because she's just not your typical professor. Students are drawn to her. They hang out in her office. You know, she goes on these field trips. She takes them. So she's very, very much involved with her students. And, you know, they call her at all hours. You know, so this is not the kind of professor that I am necessarily, because I teach writing. I do give my students my home phone number, my cell phone, and they can call me
but
at
I don't
all
answer
hours.
It.
Yeah, I know. They can call me at all hours when they're working on stories that are really, you know, I mean, sometimes they're out in the field and it's hard and they're lost or maybe it's even dangerous. And so I do keep myself open to them, but they don't necessarily come to me with these personal stories that they're going through.
Right.
Like they do with her, but that's, again, the nature of the class.
Yeah, so. Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing. So you had written always short before this. You'd written journalistic style articles. You've written for The Atlantic. Tell me about the transition from writing from short to long and some of the challenges that arise when you're going from article to book length.
So it's definitely not the same as writing an article. I had the good fortune of being able to study under people like Barry Siegel, who runs our literary journalism program at the University of California, Irvine, and Rick Meyer, who is an amazing narrative editor at the LA Times, who's really one of my closest mentors. And he, you know, I did long form, so that's different than a book too, but, you know, longer articles that that use techniques of, you know, suspense and cliffhangers and things like that to move a story forward. Mm-hmm. With a book, it's that on a much larger scale. So I just knew, again, the structure is the hardest thing because you're not dealing with a natural structure that, you know, you can just follow a story and the ending is perfect. You have to kind of impose a structure, and I did that by how I chose to unravel each story. But then it was just a matter of focusing in on where are the points of conflict, the points of high emotion, and the points of suspense that I can kind of break the chapters around and then digress into maybe another story so people are waiting for what's going to happen, you know, to this one character. They're still, you know, so that's moving the story forward. And, you know, you find those points in all your research, and that's how you kind of organize a book, too. So the book, even though it's nonfiction, is still moving, you know, there's still a reason to keep flipping the pages. You still have to find out what's going to happen.
Did you outline it?
I did outline it, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, that changed. And also I have to say, I spent one summer in New York just writing every single day from morning till night. Mm. And when I was done with that summer, I had 140,000 words, and a lot of that was digressions into research, and this is what journalists, we love to do. We do all this research, and we read all these books and studies, and we put that all in there. And we think that everybody needs to know every study that we've read. And I put those into the initial manuscript, and what the book ended up being is really very focused on the narratives, with some of that research kind of informing how I wrote the narratives and how I maybe tucked into little areas of the book. But really, it's not heavy on these academic digressions. And, you know, the book is about probably 85,000-90,000 words, so I cut a huge amount.
Yeah.
But I had to get through that kind of initial really vomit draft to get to something that was leaner and more succinct. So that's kind of the process. And I think that's probably a process for any writer, but for journalists in particular, I mean, it's very easy for us to digress into all these different stories that we find fascinating because we're constantly interested in things. But then we have to keep the reader in mind for a narrative like this. And remember, sticking to the stories is also very, very important, more important perhaps than a lot of the studies and books and interviews that we did on the side.
Right. That's what the source material is for at the end of the book, so people can go and read all that. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, unfortunately, we have drawn down on our time, but I so appreciate taking the time. Where can we find you on the web?
So you can go to my website, erikahayasaki.com, which is also thedeathclass.com. Same, both addresses go to the same site, and that has information about the book, but also has some of my old articles and things like that. I haven't updated it lately, but you know, articles, narrative articles and things like that that are all posted on there.
Wonderful.
Information about everything.
Wonderful. Erika Hayasaki, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
That was Erika Hayasaki. She is the author of The Death Class, A True Story About Life. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Debut novelist James Scott will be here in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
To see you go, come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are under iTunes. You can see us under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by James Scott. James was born in Boston and grew up in upstate New York. He holds a BA from Middlebury College and an MFA from Emerson. His fiction has appeared in Plowshares, One Story, American Short Fiction, and other publications. He lives in Western Massachusetts. The Kept is his first novel. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. James, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah. It's getting a lot of great press. It's great. So I'm going to let you introduce the book. It was 8 years in the writing and 15 years in the initial image that sort of drove the book came to you. So talk about The Kept, and without giving away too many of its secrets, kind of take us into your world here.
Yeah, that's the tough thing. The Kept is set in 1897 in upstate New York. In a winter very much like we're experiencing this winter in much of the country, just very bleak and snowy and icy. And midwife Elspeth Howell comes home to her family farm to find that her family's been murdered, all except for one of her sons, Caleb, who's 12 years old. And the two of them eventually set out to find the killers and figure out what has happened and why.
I know, that's all you can say without giving too much away, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's, you know, thematically there's lots to talk about without giving too much away, but yeah. Plot-wise, it is really hard because there are sort of a lot of spoilers, and that's made, you know, the reviews have been wonderful. I don't really read them, but they do tend to give a lot away, so it's hard not to talk about it too much, but to me, it's really about a mother's relationship with her son and with her family, even though that family's gone.
Right, right. So the initial spark for The Kept came from an image, and maybe you can talk about that image and kind of where it came from, and then how you unpacked that over the course of, yeah, you know, 8 or 15 years to turn it into a book.
Yeah, it must have been 1999 or 2000. I was just out of college and started writing a novel, and the image that began it was that of a young boy wiping the snow from a dead girl's face. Not the cheeriest image, but there it was. And I started writing the novel at that time, and I don't know whether it was that I didn't have enough sort of surrounding that one image, or if it was that I just wasn't capable of writing what I wanted to, but I eventually just sort of put it down. But the image sort of didn't put me down. It just stayed with me. And I just asked myself a lot of questions about it, you know, about, you know, who these people were, what their relationship was, and without even thinking about it, you know, the idea gained its own weight and gravity to the point that when I started my MFA program, right away I decided that I wanted to do a novel as my thesis, even though I was really there to learn to write short stories. And yeah, I think at that point, sitting down, it had enough to it that I didn't stall out so early, and I could keep going long enough and have enough behind it that when I did sort of invariably, as people do, when things sort of did slow down and the ideas weren't quite there, there was enough material that I could ask myself questions about what was in that material and keep going.
Right, right. Is that how most things start for you, is with an image, or does it often start with character or plot points? But
it's always different. I think that usually with short stories, it's typically more of a voice. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I love short stories is actually it's easier to sustain a voice that's unusual or that has more sort of quirks to it, whereas over the course of a novel, they would be annoying. But with the novel, it really was just kind of an assemblage of images and ideas. And then as it progressed, like you said, you know, it took eight and a half years about to really write it. It was just this every time I read it or every time I went back to it, a different theme would emerge. And then I would have to go back and sort of thread that theme throughout the novel so it didn't come out of nowhere and it had an arc to it. And that was what took so long. I mean, that was what
got seven of the
eight years occupied. Yeah.
Was the time period and setting, which is so much of a character in the novel, so it takes place, as you said, in the late 1800s, and in just this incredibly bleak winter setting, was that always a part of it? I mean, obviously, if he's brushing the snow off the girl's face, the winter bleakness would be a part of it, but was that always, you know, a character from the very beginning?
Yeah, pretty much. I think that so this initial image, the place that made the most sense to me to set it was the place that I'd grown up in, kind of. I needed to have enough of a separation that I wasn't too beholden to the truth. So I thought back to my childhood and taking these long drives to my grandparents' house. My grandparents lived in Syracuse near Lake Erie, and I just remembered those long drives, and I read a lot of Southern Gothic literature even when I was very young, and so I sort of married those two things because they were sort of already coupled in my mind, and I sort of fused that together with this image, and then it all, you know, came out of there, came out of that seed, which actually is a relatively large seed as far as ideas go.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is James Scott. The book is The Kept. You've been compared more than once to Cormac McCarthy. Your writing has been compared to Flannery O'Connor. Do you have other writers' sort of voices in your head when you're writing? Do you push all of that aside, or do you read other writers while you're writing, or do any of these people inform you, or does it just kind of organically come out this way?
I think it organically comes out this way. Certainly, it's extremely flattering. All of those things are extremely flattering. I've read Cormac McCarthy is sort of my guy. You know, he's the person who, you know, I've read everything he's written, and I think he's in the very, very short conversation of the greatest living writers. But I didn't read any of his books while I was writing. Which was hard because it's a long time. eight and a half years is a long time to not read your favorite writer. But it also is obviously much too long to not read at all, so I certainly read lots of other things. And I don't think I put anything down thinking it was too close to what I was doing or too close to the narrative or anything. But I think it's just a natural combination of the things that you grew up reading and the things you were influenced by and the things you've studied. And I don't think that excludes other forms of media either. I don't think it excludes movies or music or, you know, whatever else you might be ingesting. So, but certainly, you know, Flannery O'Connor's a big influence and McCarthy's a big influence and Carson McCullers and then some of the newer sort of Southern Gothic people I read, you know, either in preparation for writing the book or during the writing, like Tom Franklin and Daniel Woodrell and people like that.
I've read that you're a naturally anxious person, and I was wondering if you talk a lot about your own anxieties, and I was wondering if writing is sort of an antidote to that, or if it produces more anxieties.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, when I sit down to write, writing is one of the only things that I do where I just don't recognize the passage of time. I can just sit down and write, and, you know, 8 or 9 hours can go by. And there's nothing else that I do that's like that. I like to run a lot, and sometimes, you know, when you get into a groove running, you cannot really sort of know, you know, time sort of melts. But it doesn't ever completely disappear, whereas with writing it does. It you know, I'll forget to eat. You know, I'll stand up and I'll think, why am I so sore? And it'll be because I've been there for 5 hours without moving at all. But the thing about writing is it's such a solitary pursuit that my particular form of anxiety, a lot of it has to do with spending too much time alone and in my own head. So, like a lot of things, it's the best thing for it because it eases my anxiety while I'm in it, but I have to be sure to force myself out of it whenever I can so that when I do sort of eventually surface, it's not, the sort of outside world hasn't built up to the point that it's too much for me.
Right. I was just looking at this seminar title that's coming up, and I thought appropriate for your book as well, the Violence on the Page, How Much is Too Much? And I was wondering, you know, as you're writing, some scenes in here are, you know, horrific and hard to take.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was a problem for you, if you walk this really kind of tender line of, you know, immersing the reader, but are there points when it's, when, you know, an image too far, or did you grapple with that, or did that emerge organically as well?
I didn't grapple with it, but I think that it's because I've read enough that contains violence that I understand sort of where my line is, where the demarcation point for me is between writing violence that has an impact as opposed to writing violence that feels exploitative or, you know, I mean, it can feel pornographic. I mean, you can read some of the, you know, some books and the violence is described in this almost ecstatic way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that at all. I didn't want to celebrate it. I didn't want it to seem, you know, like art or a ballet. I wanted it to seem like very real and very true. And so there's a point at which if you're looking away and you're having the reader look away, you're being dishonest. And so I think the images that are in there are enough to get the point across without having it be, you know, inorganic to the story, where it's just sort of like, I'm describing this so that you will feel horrified. And that, you know, and that's what horror is, and that was clearly not my intention. So to have an impact but not have it feel, again, like I'm exploiting the characters or the situations is sort of the space I want to be in.
Right. And you do it so well.
Thank you very much.
The book has this great opening line, Elspeth Howell was a sinner. And then you kind of unpack a little bit from there, you know, not her particular crimes, but sort of the general way she was a sinner. How early did that opening line come to you?
Oh, goodness. It's, I think it was there from the moment that Elspeth opened the book. Because initially Caleb opened the book. I mean, as I said, that image of him wiping the snow, you know, initially was very close to the beginning of the book, and now it's actually Elspeth who's the first person, you know, in terms of the chronology of the book, but not the plot, who wipes the snow from Emma's face. So, but I think as soon as I decided that the book should start with her returning home to what has happened, that line was pretty much always there. And It's a tough one sometimes. I know there are some people have reacted a certain way to it, and that's fine, of course. But I love it. Like, I'd love to make T-shirts.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
I'll buy your T-shirt. I like it.
Oh, great. Good. One sale.
Yeah, actually, that sort of bleeds into my next question, which is about revision. And you have said that revision was your favorite class at Emerson, and that you would physically cut the story apart into component pieces and hang the pieces on the wall, and sort of that physicality of, you know, literally cutting the story up and looking at it hanging on the wall was helpful to you. Talk a little bit about your revision process, how much you have when you start to put the pieces together, and how your room physically looks when you're doing that.
It looks like a mess, and I need to keep the door shut because my wife is very tidy and she does not like to gaze upon what looks like insanity. I do, pardon me, I just had a sneeze. I cut the story apart physically. You know, it's very kindergarten. It's markers and tape and scissors, and I cut it apart scene by scene and hang it up on the wall or lay it out on the floor, depending on how much of it there is. And I sort of walk around it and look at it and, you know, think about the rhythm of the scenes and the weight of the scenes, and, you know, if a scene is too long, obviously it has to be cut, and you know, the value of each scene. And so at the top of each of each of those sections, I'll write what that scene is actually about. And then as I progress, I'll say, you know, what themes it's discussing and sort of what characters are involved, what's revealed in each of those scenes. And if you're not doing a number of those things, then it's not the right scene. And you end up having to cut it. And then sometimes, you know, I'll realize that a scene is missing. Very often I'll realize a scene is missing. And a lot of times that comes out of a fear of not wanting to put too fine a point on things sometimes, or a fear of writing something that you're not capable of. So a lot of times the missing scenes will actually be very key scenes that I've sort of written my way around, which I think psychologically is a natural thing to do, because you need to figure out what that scene really has to do before you can actually tackle it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I will take those pieces and put them in a stack, and I will retype the scenes from those cards or from those sections, not from the original, you know, document I read on a computer. So that every time you're rewriting it, you're thinking about every word and the language and making sure that, you know, the flow is right and the rhythm is right and that things are falling into place. And then I'll do that several times, and then I read aloud a lot. So a lot of this does look like a scene from A Beautiful Mind or something, where you walk into the room and there are papers, you know, taped up all over the walls and spread out on the floors, and I'll be talking to myself, reading my own work. But I think that the reason is anything you can do to divorce yourself from your own language and your own words is good.
Mm.
And it fast-forwards the editing process, and it to some extent replicates what you can get from a workshop, like the best thing that you can get from a workshop, which is you can see what you've done in a slightly different light from a slightly different angle. And all of those things, you know, all those things are great. I think that they take a long time is the drawback. But I've never cut a story up or cut a chapter up and been unhappy that I did so. You know, occasionally I'll take a step backwards, but very, very, very rarely.
Do you do something similar for the characters? Because it strikes me that you'd have to know kind of, you know, each character has their own world of secrets that you mm-hmm. have to understand, you know, their point of view, even if it's not being written from their point of view. And, you know, kind of keeping track of character arc as well as scene and plot arc.
Yeah, and character arc was really difficult in this book, because each of the characters, the story is told from two points of view, from Elspeth's point of view and Caleb's point of view, and they're very, very, I mean, they couldn't be any more different.
Right.
And to make sure that each was weighted properly and to make sure that they were advancing as characters in a way that was satisfying to the reader, I definitely had to measure those things out. And so one of the ways that I would do that is I would write out the scenes on index cards as opposed to actually printing them out, and I would sort of hang Caleb's scenes on the wall at one level and Elspeth's at another level, and that way, you know, looking through, I could see, oh, I'm spending twice as much time on Caleb as I am on Elspeth, or, you know, Elspeth hasn't had a long scene in two chapters, and, you know, why is that? And again, usually it comes out of the fear of, you know, not being capable of writing something that you want to.
Right.
And so a lot of times when I would see that I wasn't writing a lot of Caleb or wasn't writing a lot of Elspeth, it was that I was afraid to write a particular scene or have a particular revelation for the character.
Right.
And so I would need to really, really think about where that could fit, and that would, it would seem to change the arc, but actually it would just return the arc to sort of where it naturally should be.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. We've drawn down on our time. Is there a last-minute writing advice for new novelists now that you're one book in?
Well, don't take 8 years would be my first piece of advice. It's the opposite advice, which is that it takes how long it takes. You know, however long it takes is how long it's going to take. And I wouldn't trade in any of that 8.5 years, because when I was going through the proofreader, when I was going through the proofs with Harper, I did get to a point where I thought, oh, I'm happy with this. Like, I've actually finished this book, and I never thought I would feel that way. And it's the best feeling. It's one of the best feelings I've ever had. So I think there's a tendency to want to rush and to get it to an agent and get it to an editor and blah, blah. And it's just, you know, it takes however long it takes. And just be patient with yourself and let things emerge naturally and trust that and trust that you'll do that.
I have to tell you, after talking to a lot of authors, 8 years is not that long. I mean, it's, you know, it's on the spectrum of totally normal for how long it takes people to write a novel. It's a long process, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. It just takes a long time. And especially, I think the more themes you have and the deeper you want to get, the longer it's just going to take to figure everything out.
That's right. That's right. James Scott, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. Where do we find you on the web?
JamesScottWriter.com.
Exactly right.
Thanks for having me.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
That was James Scott. The novel is The Kept. That's all the time we have for this Wednesday morning, but we'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Teddy is on giving you some rhythms and reggae this morning, so stay tuned for that. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.